Tacky Talk Time, State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy is looking very professional today in a suit and in his office, Tacky.
Hey, good afternoon, Joe. Yeah, I'm in the office today. We've had a formal session yesterday, and we're having another formal session today on June 27th. As I've said multiple times, our formal session ends on midnight, August 1st, essentially July 31st. So we're in that time period where the formal sessions are picking up.
And the fiscal year starts on Monday, so we've got an interim budget, right?
Yeah, we have a 1/12 budget that we passed yesterday, which is an interim budget, so the government does not shut down. What we do is we take the current fiscal year, because the fiscal year isn't over yet, divided by 1/12, take out some of the one-time appropriations and some other adjustments that are not baseline budget, to ensure that the government functions to the month of August. The FY25 budget will be adjusted when it comes out of conference committee regarding the one-month payment in August through a carryover budget. A comptroller will do the accounting in October, and it all kind of works out in the end. Basically, the bean counters will figure this out.
Right.
The numbers will always balance out because the comptroller accounting mechanisms will do this, and this is not an unusual practice for us. So it's not like the various agencies and the various accounting agencies does not know how to manage this in proper accounting and has no effect on the bottom line of the FY25 budget. So not unusual. And if the budget signed sooner, obviously the 1/12 budget is remaining days of the 1/12 budget is voided, and then the FY25 budget take effect. And again, like I said, the reconciliations occur in October. So not the most exciting bill, by the way, the reconciliation bill, just to let you know. Like, everybody is so geared up in the month of October for reconciliation. So, but that's where we are. And it's also cool, relatively cool in my office. So I'm hoping people are enjoying this weather as we're heading to July 4th weekend.
Yes, it's hard to believe it's here already. Matter of fact, I was reading the last time the state budget was approved in June was in 2010.
Well, it's easy when you literally have no money.
Right.
It was after the Great Financial Crisis, which the previous budgets kept revising down figures. This happened in 2003 to 2005. Every time we blinked, we kept revising revenue numbers down. And it was getting tougher and tougher in the Great Financial Crisis. So the getting on time, still based on estimates. But, it's, again, not necessarily unusual to find ourselves in a situation to not make the June 30th deadline for the governor. I hate to say it's kind of like a not uncommon. But unlike other states, the government doesn't shut down. And like other states, they don't have a full-time legislature. So many states will function on a several months basis. If you're Texas, you only come once every 2 years, unless you call a special session. So they have like only one out of 2 years, they have a session for essentially four-ish months, or give or take a few days, and they have special sessions after that. So it's really tricky to compare legislatures around the country, because every legislature functions differently. And, supermajority legislatures do not have a full-time schedule. Believe it or not, I didn't realize this, but many legislatures don't have public hearings. They do not have open public hearings, unlike Massachusetts. Much to my surprise, as I talk to other folks around the country when I get a chance, and compare notes on how they do business. So on the flip side, the governors in those states have enormous authority. They have a lot of flexibility in how they operate. In Massachusetts, the legislature likes to exert itself on the executive branch as much as possible to push forward the interests of our constituencies. Some states have 2 months budgets. I think Illinois is a state that runs on a two-year budget. Yeah, I think Illinois is a state where they have a two-year budget, where the legislature basically sets a budget for 2 years and doesn't come in again.
Interesting. Yeah. So what's left to do in Massachusetts?
Well, there's a lot on the books. I think, read from the papers. Our housing bond bill is heading to conference committee. We have an information technology bond bill. We have economic development bill that we're going to be doing today. 644 amendments we're going to be debating today. Obviously, it's not done there as yet, so we're waiting for that. There's a healthcare bill. There's a assisted living facility licensing bill. Again, the remnants of COVID and our discoveries of how assisted facilities for seniors were not functioning well and how we need to make it better. There's the gun control, gun reform bill, depending how you want to frame it, still sitting in conference committee. So there's a lot of stuff moving around the branches, plus obviously a number of smaller bills moving around between the branches as well. So it's going to be very active July. So I think sometimes some of the things get left off the big newspapers and the big media is the smaller bills that are constantly moving between the branches and state house news services, as you subscribe to, is constantly trying to keep up with small items.
So, what of note has been accomplished so far, Jackie?
It's been quiet.
Mm-hmm.
going to tell you, when we get to July, it's going to be like, what haven't you done yet? Right? And I think that's going to be the real crux of it all. What haven't you done? So as we continue our conversations into July, into August, going through the stuff that may or may not survive the governor's desk, because the governor has 10 days after July 31st to sign a bill into law, veto a bill. I think you'll a better understanding of where we are at the end of this session. And oddly enough, it actually gives us a clue what may start next session with, particularly anything that's unfinished. And that's kind of a fun conversation for us to have in August about, what was left on the table as well, not just stuff that. So I think the answer to the question really is the opposite. What haven't we done? What's
Well, tell me about an accomplishment for dealing with tax liens on property.
Yeah, we passed a bill here that's heading over to the Senate that we voted on yesterday. So you may have seen on the news, especially Channel 5 News, WCVB, the series of stories regarding municipalities being able to foreclose on a homeowner who does not pay their property taxes and or their water sewer bills. And after they do a number of reasonable attempts for payment, they can foreclose on your home and take the value of the whole property beyond just what you owe the municipality. So let's say you owe, let's say, 2 grand. Let's pick a big number. Let's say you owe $10,000 in water, sewer, and property, or just property, doesn't matter what combination. And you have a home that's valuation on the open market is $100,000. Well, you attempt, for whatever reason, you are unable to pay this bill. Perhaps you are intentionally not doing it. Perhaps you attempt to do it, but is unable to work with the community. And the municipality goes, all right, well, we've done everything we can. We're just going to foreclose them. So they put all the liens on your property and proceed to foreclose. And after some length of time for the foreclosure, the municipality gets to keep the value of your home. So 100, as opposed to paying the municipality $10,000, and you get $90,000 of the value of a $100,000 home. The municipality keeps $100,000, you come up with nothing.
Wow, okay. That's seems like downright robbery.
It is absolutely legalized robbery. The U.S. Supreme Court and state Supreme Court has ruled this as unconstitutional. And state Supreme Court basically said that it's the legislature, you got to fix this, to be in compliance with both the state and the U.S. Supreme Court in this matter. So if you haven't seen the WCVB, I believe it's WCVB stories on this, particularly in the city of Worcester, which has been the most egregious, it looks like, it's fascinating and quite scary. So, Mark Cusack, the chair of revenue, our good friend from Braintree, worked on this bill. And we voted on yesterday to set up some mechanisms and guidelines for city and towns to follow as they move through this process for non-payment of taxes and or a non-payment of water sewer bills. And then, set up sufficient notice and set up a process for a homeowners to recover the equity value that's left over after paying everyone's debts off. So at least you won't lose 100% value, ensures all debt holders are made whole that may be on the lien, such as a mortgage, such as a home contractor, beyond just the city and town. So it creates mechanisms to ensure that everybody's made whole, and also, including the homeowner if that unfortunate circumstance comes up. I know the city and towns, I won't, do a blanket statement, but I'll say that many of them would like to try to get their payments and will work with a homeowner. But it's up to the homeowner to also return to cooperate with the city and town about it, on paying their taxes and water sewer bills. And obviously, we saw a lot of home foreclosures or abandonments. Believe it or not, even Massachusetts people abandoned homes during the great financial crisis in 08. And that's bad for all of us, because
Right. Well, they owed so much more than the properties were worth at that point, right?
yeah, and that's bad for all of us
Right.
because that reduces your taxes, and you end up picking more to burden for a non-taxpayer or a non-water sewer payer. It's a
Right.
cost. So, I'm not saying a case with every community. Okay, I'm not going to make that blanket statement, but many communities want to get their money. So you, as a taxpayer who do pay your taxes, aren't burdened by someone who doesn't. And
So the goal is to work out a payment plan, right? I'm assuming.
yeah,
Yeah.
and hope they can figure this out among themselves. But I mean, the most extreme cases is a home foreclosure. But again, it's also some fairness here. The municipality and the taxpayer should get full recovery from the person not paying their taxes. Same time, though, the remaining value of the home minus all the debt that's owed to other entities, should belong to the homeowner.
Right. So when you say foreclosed, is that it's forcing a sale of the property? Is that
Yeah,
what
I'm
that
sorry,
means?
forcing a sale. Yeah,
Okay.
I'm sorry, I can for do a for sale. It's not a conventional foreclosure. That's correct. A mortgage
Right.
I could foreclose because non-payment mortgage.
Gotcha.
City
Okay.
or town could do a for sale. That's the
Gotcha.
best part.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's good. So that's a House passed it, still in the Senate?
Yeah, well, I fully expect the Senate will pass this. They're going to make some changes, but I'm going to be doubtful to be many changes. But this is something that really needs to happen, and I'm hopeful we can do this in July.
Okay, very good. That's something. See, you did do something.
Well, it's not on the governor's desk. Part of we got two categories: something we actually done, something the Senate's done, and something has to be written into law. So
Okay.
once the governor starts signing stuff into law, it's kind of like done.
What? Yeah, I got you. Yeah. And so, as soon as I read a quote from the speaker just earlier this week, actually, he's not surprised at all at how this process is going. He, given the nature of the negotiations, he says people try to hold on to the very last minute.
Again, deadlines create urgency.
Yeah.
I'm not in, high leadership who has to negotiate directly with the Senate president and the leadership folks on the other side. I'm sure if you ask John Keenan, same issue. We're doing the best in our little chairs and our, sector of the world, continue to advocate to other chairs. That's just because you're a chair doesn't mean you don't advocate to another chair, as well as work with other legislators in the building to move bills along. And this is kind of where we are. Everyone here is trying to get a bill moved, and given the fact that we won't have any other appropriations, to my knowledge, this cycle, I mean, any more ask for money is pretty much not going to happen. Although the city of Quincy is getting $75,000 for tourism money for the 250th anniversary, I believe, for
Ah.
the Constitution. So, the Quincy delegation was able to slip into the 112 budget as part of $20 million of grants around the state for addressing 250th anniversary for community. So, that makes a lot of sense. I don't see a whole lot of opportunities for anyone to make, big requests as part of like an election cycle money earmarks for home, whatever we have is there. And there'll be a chance to earmark some bond money. I mean, the Economic Development Bond Bill has a large swath of different type of economic development bond tax credit opportunities. So there may be some earmarking there, but in terms of like cash, I don't see it really at this point.
Yeah. Okay. All right. One, and you mentioned the housing bond bill too. That's still in negotiations.
That's in conference committee now. The Senate did their housing bond bill. I think they're doing it today. I'm trying to think because they did energy last week and they did energy and housing. They did energy this week. They did housing last week. So yeah, so that's gone to conference committee.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
It's hard to
Interesting.
track with, yeah, it's hard to track in your head off the top
Yeah.
of your head.
So one interesting aspect of that to me anyway is the expansion of the MWRA district. I'd be curious to see how that pans out.
The MWRA Quabbin has a lot of water. They're at actually very high capacity. Combine that with greater water usage efficiency, because believe it or not, we actually are being more efficient using our water. There's opportunities for other communities that are well-based communities to join the NRA that is south of Quincy. Speaker's very interested in trying to expand economic development regionally, not just, in Quincy. But I always tell folks you basically have to have specific items to expand economic development. You have electricity, you need water, you need sewer, and believe it or not, you actually do need natural gas. So, water and sewer is kind of the first battle. And that includes, places like the Quincy Shipyard, right? I mean, you could do a monster development of any sort. It's going to consume a lot of resources. So, and of course, the expansion of housing. So, you go to like South Weymouth Naval Air Station, another large plot of land that has been trying to be developed for the last 40 years for all intents and purposes. And, increased access to water and sewer is actually pretty important for a large-scale development. You don't have that, then, you shouldn't even bother trying. So we expect that, I don't know where that's going to fit in negotiation between the House and Senate, because obviously the Senate president doesn't represent any part of Southeast. She's Metro West.
Agawam, I think, or Ashland.
Natick.
Natick, okay.
Natick. So she has a whole different interest out there. So I'm not sure that's good, but it is actually very interesting because that's been one of the major issues. Because if you want to participate in MWRA community, that community actually has to share the infrastructure costs. You as an MWRA ratepayer does not pay for the infrastructure for the hookup.
So it's initial upfront cost there, yeah.
It is a lot for cost. So there's no outside assistance. It's very costly for a community to hook up to the MWRA.
So would the state absorb that, or would that be up to each community?
The proposal that's in the House of Bond was set aside some bond money as in the form of grants to allow access provided, of course, that you want to participate and you can demonstrate you can do it.
Right. So would there have to be a local vote, do you think, in some cases?
Yeah, they're going to have to provide a plan, and I believe they're going to probably have to come up with some share of the cost. I don't think it's a 100% freebie. So generally, the upfront cost is generally about 20%, give or take. I mean, that's the case. I mean, people, unfortunately think that it's free money from the government. Very few programs are 100% free from the state and the feds. Generally, it's a 10 or 20% match. And that applies to, all the school building assistance stuff. That's anywhere between 10 and 40%, for the is picked up by the city of Quincy, and then state picks up 60 and 90%, depending on what project you're talking about. So, often that's kind of lost in the municipal conversation. The budget is that, people are under some pressure. Well, it's all Fed money, it's free. Maybe some of it could be, but more likely than not, bigger projects require a 10 or 20%.
The mayor told me that the new Squantum School will get about a 65% state reimbursement. So that still leaves the city on the hook for 35%.
Yeah, and that's your bonds. That's taxpayers and city picks of that part of bonds. And then the other part of the 65% is amortized to all the taxpayers in the Commonwealth. To be honest with you, again, City of Quincy is actually, it's a pretty big city in terms of the state. I know it's not a big city nationally, but in terms of the state of Massachusetts, and every dollar state that top tax dollar you put in, because of the nature size of the city and our needs, we tend to do better than like a rural community or a wealthy community in terms of tax dollars returned.
So, and you hope that it balances out on the other side, right? With needs for their communities.
Yeah, that's MWRA example really good because, while we have had like all the sewer pump stations redone in the last 25 years in the city, we've had a lot of water mains done. We have the high pressure water sewer main that's underneath Walls and Beach that was redone in the last 25 years. You obviously have Nut Island, it sends a sewage to Deer Island. That's paid for by ratepayers in Central Mass. However, when they were doing reservoir water sheltering, which covered reservoir, covered the top of reservoirs, certain reservoirs, as well as increased sense of monitoring in those communities regarding potential toxicity, especially in the world of potential terrorist threats. You as a ratepayer in Quincy is paying for those infrastructure components out in the central part of central Metro West, central well Metro West, Central Mass is really Worcester, but Metro West. So, while they paid for our three massive sewer pump upgrades, plus high pressure sewer main under Walls Beach, we picked up the cost on security shelters or reservoirs, and increased monitoring on potential toxicities. So it's kind of one of those things where, yeah, you pay water and sewer bill, and you're like, oh, well, why should you pay for someone else? Because someone already paid for us. And it's the same principle with tax money at some level where we have big bond bills. The reality is Quincy is, a major recipient of Chapter 90 bond money. We get, about 9% of the total bond allocation, but that's spread around the state. So a small community is actually paying more money in tax dollars than you are as a Quincy state income taxpayer, because we take a bigger share of the bond money in Chapter 90. So yeah, if you travel to Western Mass as an elected official from Eastern Mass, there is sometimes how do I put this, not liking you.
A little professional animosity.
Yeah, those electeds in Western Mass, particularly the local electeds, are very conscious about how the resource allocation is made regarding state tax dollars and how
Sure.
urbanized areas collect a lot more, especially those in Eastern Massachusetts.
So they're advocating strongly for their constituents, I'm sure.
Yes, they're much more attuned to where their tax dollars go, and I think many ways than we do, because we generally will take it for granted, thus in the greater Boston area.
Sure. I guess the big local story this week, Tacky, as you're well aware, is the announcement that ENC is closing.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks have been watching ENC for many years now, has been aware they've been in a severe financial crisis. They've not been able to make their census in terms of fully full staffing, actually full student attendance. I mean, they generally get to about, if they're lucky, half of what they need to maintain their survivability in terms of tuition. Of course, tuition's gone up. Smaller universities in the state has gone down. I mean, Mount Ida's clearly the most famous one in the state that's gone down, but it's not the only one. There's going to be more as we go along. I suspect in the next 5 years, enrollment's down nationally because, frankly, people aren't having children. We're in a segment of population where they only have one child, not two or three. I suspect the generation, next generation, the millennial generation is not going to have also a lot of children, and it really, changes the economics of higher education. I'm aware that the mayor, last year in the council had passed an ordinance to convert that to senior housing. But I also remind folks, if you live in that area, it's a flood zone. Those ball fields, all the green space is actually crucial to try to keep water retention in the area. And it's not lost on me that, all those streets actually are a slope from Eastern Nazarene going downhill. So, doing a major development would be very hard without addressing flooding issues. But I'm not sure what's going to happen in the future. I mean, I've been informed that, student relocation is actively going on now. Division of Higher Education under the Department of Higher Education is already on top of the issue. So they already started placement, and they will work to place all students somewhere else to ensure their credits go with them. I've been informed that the school will formally close down at the end of this year. So they're not close yet. So obviously, they have security concerns as well as maintenance concerns. But their formal process begun, but they won't shut down to the end of the year. Their contract on the Migrant Welcome Center will also terminate at the end of this year, or inside that same zone of time. And those who may not be aware, the apartments there, many were not quite up to code, and had to be brought up to code at a minimum level before the migrant situation, which is very transitory. The apartments are not designed to live, a full year. So, and of course, a lot of classroom labs and a beautiful library, plus there's a gym and a giant ball field. So I'm not quite sure what the Eastern National College wants to do with that property. Obviously, it has enormous value. But again, it's a flood zone. It's very sensitive. It's not lost on you folks, for those who live down there, that it's the top side of a downhill slope. Whatever happens on development there is going to have an adverse impact on you. I do not know what the city plan is, other than the fact that obviously they passed an ordinance. But overall, it's not poorly maintained. I do suspect that the church itself is not part of the campus. The church is a separate legal entity from the campus. So I'm not quite sure what the status is. I'm sure you have to ask somebody over there. But in the short term, the immediate concern is ensuring placement of students with their credits someplace else.
Right. And the faculty and staff, too, obviously, is a concern, too.
Absolutely, because they already had downsized the school programming for years, but th this is at the very end of the trail on that one as well. So, yeah, and I always remind folks, not-for-profit entities are a major employer. It's not always just a for-profit corporation. A big not-for-profits are major employers, which have a definite economic impact, where they're located as well as where people live.
Right. So, and I've heard people say, well, we're going to lose the taxes. They don't pay taxes.
Yeah, it's not for profit, so there's no tax impact.
Right.
But it may have some minor impacts on Wallace and Center. People from the Nazarene use Wallace and Center amenities, not just students, but year-long staff. So there may be some impact.
Yeah, it's definitely a piece of Quincy history. That's going away for sure.
Yeah, it's like 124 years or something like
Yeah.
that. Yeah, it's been there since I was a child, obviously. So, but I mean, the campus footprint, I'm trying to remember, it's because I was a kid. I don't remember what the footprint's always been the same, but I always thought there was like small expansion over the years, but not like huge, like sprawling expansion.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know they purchased real estate in the area, when they needed it, housing, things like that. But that's been selling off over the past few years too, because of the financial challenges.
Yeah, and they have built that place where they're going to put the D. Christopher Special Education
Right.
building. The NAS built that in hopes of trying to drain some secondary revenue, and that never truly materialized as well.
No, so they did sell that to the city. So yeah. They have referred, I've inquired several times. They've referred me to a PR firm that they hired. So basically they're not talking right now.
Yeah, I've not had for any communication with the school either. We've been talking to obviously the state agencies that deal with it. We'll get more updates from those state agencies as we move forward. We've dealt with this before with the Division of Higher Education when we had the Quincy College crisis.
That's right.
And they went in and started trying to figure out survivability and what can and cannot be done. And it required a changing of a college president, but also an enormous consumption of its reserve fund. Eventually, they returned to its nursing program later on after some reforms of the operations. So, I mean, obviously, East NAS is a totally different scenario, but it's not the first time the delegations have had to talk to that agency about its next steps. But this one obviously is a definitely end of an era circumstance.
Yeah, for sure. Can we talk about a couple of ballot questions, Jackie? The Supreme Court actually is looks like it's going to allow the ballot question regarding app-based drivers and the MCAS exams.
Yeah, just remind folks. I mean, people can't petition the ballot questions to the Supreme Court, question the constitutionality of it. Ballot questions can only pertain to one topic. It has to be framed in a single question. It can be a complex law, but the complex law has to address a single question. And then, obviously, there's no constitutional violations because it doesn't impede on how the Constitution operates. And so, I mean, those are kind of the two barriers. I'm sure there's a few more, but those are the two areas to look for with this constitutional violation, whether or not, it is actually a single question, not a multi-layer question. For example, an impediment on the Constitution is a ballot question instructing the legislature how to spend money. You cannot instruct the legislature how to spend money by ballot question. You can create like the so-called millionaire's tax with generalizations of where to spend, but it can't name like give Joe Catalano $1 million.
I
You
see.
can do that. You can create generalizations in transportation and education, but we get to figure out what that really means, right? So, both questions, met the muster of not violating the state constitution and also, actually addresses one question. It doesn't matter how many words in this proposed law would be, it's whether or not the totality of that law answers one question. And a multi-layer, you can't do like one question like 15 parts.
Gotcha.
So challenges are always would go after those two particular issues. And more often than not, the Supreme Judicial Court will side with the Attorney General that there is no violation. But yeah, they're out collecting signatures. I suspect all of them will collect sufficient signatures by August, and you will see it on the ballot this November. Secretary of State does put a guidebook out, as well as put online materials for the proponents' opponent statements, as well as the text of these proposed laws for you to reveal. And then we'll see if there's an advertising campaign by people for and against to try to sway you into voting for and against ballot question.
So, yep, looks also the one fair wage question is making headway as well, and I think the psychedelic mushrooms question too.
The one for wage war gets a little complicated regarding restaurant workers, in particular, servers getting minimum wage equivalent to everyone else. But they get tip income, and it's a little bit complicated because of that. I'm not even sure what the psychedelics actually does in terms of its regulatory process. I still can't figure it out how the law works. And this is a guy that regulates stuff. Committee chair that knows how to, knows how to regulate things, and I don't understand how this questions. I understand the intent. I don't understand how it actually works.
Yeah, it'll be, like I said, it'll be curious to see that information booklet that the Secretary of State puts out to see how it's described.
A lot of this voter ballot question intent is not always equivalent to what's actually written in the proposal in terms of the actual law change, because it's two different worlds. And expectation as you as a voter is to read the proposed law. And then which that's kind of unreasonable to expect that people can read a proposed law and just know what that proposal is.
Well, if you're not an attorney and don't understand legalese, then they do provide a kind of a summary, which is helpful.
But even for attorneys, I mean, legislative drafting is a specialized art. And I've been drafting bills for a while, so not like you need everything perfect when you send a bill to my committee, but I can see it and I can kind of see what the intent is, so I have a general idea we're trying to get to. And then it's all about trying to amend the bill to get to where your intent's going. So we do a lot of that with the membership in here. If someone has a good idea, but the drafting needs a little bit of help, and we try to discern how to get to where you need to go, get a favorable word from the committee. So
Right.
sometimes the intent idea is not good, and then we just don't do it. But it isn't from the lack of us trying to make an effort to help you out. This is different because it's a ballot question. So, there's no committee chair or legislator, stating, helping you out on trying to understand this. And frankly, I'm having difficulty understanding it too in terms of the details and implementation. If you get past the intent, it's still how you put it into play.
Right, and these are not referendums. These are not polls, basically. These are legitimate questions.
Yeah, they'll have an effective date on each of these ballot questions on when the date of implementation is. The legislature can obviously amend and change any initiative that goes into effect. We also can delay the effective date of ballot initiatives. It's almost never, never, almost never a legislature actually repeals a ballot initiative. The last time that happened was in clean elections, where a ballot question came out essentially polling the members as a referendum, asking voters what they thought. And it turns out that after some experimentation on the elections, the voters didn't like it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So that's the one I can remember that was actually repealed by the legislature after doing a referendum to gauge the mood of the public, and the public was no.
See, that's what happens when you've been around a while, Tacky. You remember all these things.
Well, it's like the term limits question. Term limits question was essentially ruled a violation eventually on the Constitution, because only the Constitution can set our terms of office. So doing it by ballot question, not a constitutional question, was illegal, ruled by the Supreme Judicial Court. I don't even know how that one got passed. This was before my time here. I was surprised that the AG at the time, I think it was it Hoshbar or was it Shannon? I can't remember which AG was here. Actually, let that question go.
Yeah, interesting. How do you amend the state constitution?
You can do a petition to change the Constitution from the public, or a legislator could file a constitutional amendment. By constitution, we appear three times a year to take up constitutional amendment questions, or we don't have to act on it. Constitutional amendments has to be approved by a joint session of the legislature, a joint session of the House and Senate together. And it has to be approved in two different legislative cycles.
Okay.
Meaning that if I approve one, let's say this week, this is the 2003-2004 legislative cycle, it would have to be approved again in the 2025-2026 legislature. If it is approved by the joint session of the House and Senate, then it goes to the ballot at the next election cycle, which is the even numbers for, you know, legislators, for other voters to approve. Now, the problem you've seen I had a brain freeze on is the barrier of vote at the Constitutional Convention. So I'm trying to remember, because the ballot initiative process has a different threshold for the Constitutional Convention vote than it is for a legislator's initiative.
Oh, okay.
This is what I'm going to get wrong. And that's what I'm trying to remember. Because in one version, you need 25% plus one. In another version, you need 50% plus one.
Oh, okay.
Here's the difference.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember which is which now off the top of my head. Because I think if it's a public ballot question, it's 50% plus one.
Okay.
If it's legislators' ballot, a constitutional change, it is 25% plus
one. Interesting.
Pick back with me next week on that to see if I'm
okay.
Because it could have the other way around.
All right. Okay.
And
just to show you folks, we don't script these. This is totally backsliding tacky.
I'm going to have to look it up. And another interesting thing is that even though it's a joint session, the Senate president chairs the joint session.
Yep.
But the House has the majority of votes because with 160 House members and 40 senators. But because the chair of the session is the Senate president, they control the schedule and the agenda and the rulings. And the Senate clerk is the parliamentarian for the purposes of rules, questions in a constitutional convention.
Okay. Wow. That was a good test, Jackie.
Yeah, except one part I can't remember off the top of my head.
That's all right. No, you know what? It was just curious. It just came into my head when we were talking about this. I wanted to say, I wonder how you do amend that. So that's interesting. And it's set up deliberately to take a long time, right? This is how the founding fathers wanted it.
That's correct. The founding fathers intentionally set this up for a long haul, because it gives time for the legislature and the public to digest something that's been debated up here, but making such a major change, which is a change to the Constitution, which is,
right,
you know, once you put it in, it's equally difficult to take it out.
Right.
And even the Constitutional Convention is a balancing act. While the House has the majority of votes, the Senate controls the gavel. So it creates a dynamic of trying to balance out the branches, even though they're not equal in number, on the Constitutional Convention debate.
Yep. It's trying to just keep the balance of power as equal as possible.
Yes. The founding fathers were extremely conscientious of, you know, how to make this work. And, you know, it's a deliberative process and gives the public, you know, more time to digest the proposal, as well as legislators to digest the proposal. Mm-hmm. By having two legislative sessions, you could potentially have a new membership coming in that may not represent the vote they had in the prior session. And it's entirely possible that, you know, members in one session may vote differently in a separate section once they have more time to digest their options and understanding what the rules are being made.
Yep. It's, you know, it just highlights again the importance of voting, you know, and of being an active member of civic society to make sure you represent people that represent your interests.
Well, it also gave advocates essentially 3+ years.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity to advocate to the public and advocate to the legislature to position a constitutional amendment.
Right. Okay, enough of constitutional law. Let's move on to more fun things. What's happening in the district for the 4th of July?
Well, we have Porch Fest this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
We talked a little about that last time on our call on the 29th. And then, you know, we have a couple of family events. House Nick has officially scheduled a family fun day event in the, you know, I believe 10 a.m. I'm trying to remember the time now. 10 a.m. on Edgewater Drive on July 3rd. They have Marymount Beach has for their neighborhood and membership an event in the evening on also July 4th. And we have the four different types of parades in Germantown, Adams Shore, Marymount, and Squantum. Obviously, I represent Germantown, Adams Shore, and Marymount. So I've been attending those events every single year and enjoy seeing the neighbors and the kids. And, it's actually kind of nice. It's just a very long day, especially if it's a very hot day. It's a very long day. It's a longer day for folks at the Squantum too. So,
This is true. Yes, they have their road race actually, Bruce Ayers road race on Saturday.
yeah. Oh yeah, no, good luck to Bruce and everyone participating in that. As you can tell, I don't envy people who are citywide candidates in this city.
It's a lot of work. It's a big city.
Well, driving from Swan to Marymount, inside of 30 minutes. I believe this year's step off for the parade starts about 12:30 at Marymount. So normally I'm used to having a 1 o'clock kickoff, but it looks like it's going to be 12:30. So they're going to try to move the parade, and there will not be a ceremony at the beach in Marymount this year. There's going to end the parade, and people are going to head home right after to their family and friends and enjoy the remaining afternoon, however you like to enjoy it. And it's also the Thursday, so it's going to be actually again these kind of like what are people doing during the holiday season in terms of like the first big time off. July 4th is really the big time off week. So do people actually take a week off? Do they just take a long weekend? I mean, Thursday holidays is kind of curious that way.
Yeah, I think it'll be a little bit of both. I think a lot of folks will have the whole week. Some folks will start their vacation on 4th of July and go the next week. So it'd be a accommodation, I think.
Yeah, attendance is always, a head scratcher for me because I'm, not clear on people's travel. AAA is predicting a very heavy traffic travel on July 4th weekend. The airlines have been tempering back their forecasts regarding summer travel, but as I like to say, you look at the price of gas and demand generally will shift because the expectations of higher travel drive the price of gasoline up, and the gasoline prices hasn't spiked heavily, but that could change by next Monday. For all I know. But generally, gasoline spikes in the summer it equals heavy travel.
So and air travel is no bargain, that's for sure.
No, fuel prices are a real driver. Obviously, worker shortage has been an issue all over the country, but especially in the airline industry. And even after COVID, it got much more efficient in terms of reducing flights on non-profitable routes where they need to make a minimum number of folks that have to be on a plane to create profit.
Yeah. Interestingly, have you heard the recent news about electric vehicles and folks shying away from them?
Yeah, electric vehicle sales downs a lot. And I think there's a combination of factors. One is that the Biden and our state tax credits regarding electric vehicles, and everybody who wanted an electric vehicle got an electric vehicle. They're not buying a second electric vehicle. Those who do not have the means to get electric vehicle, even with the tax credits, are not going to buy an electric vehicle. Hybrid vehicles have become very popular again. There's a higher demand for those. But also people aren't changing to cars quickly. Interest rates are still very high, 6+, 7+% to get a car loan. And the average lifespan of all vehicles is averaging more than 12 years now. And I suspect, because of the impacts of inflation, higher interest rate on getting a car loan, as well as the price of cars, being high. I don't expect people trading in any of their cars, doesn't matter electric or non-electric, not trading in or getting rid of a car until they can afford to do so. Or your car literally just falls apart in front of you and you forget your new car. So, I'm not looking to get a new car loan, tell you that much. But my thought has always been that when those tax credits came up, anybody who could afford to get a car, electric car, use those credits. And it was like a one-time thing because you figured get it now. But people have a cycle of cars. It's not like you buy a car every year, right? And there's also a flood now. Hertz failed attempt at Tesla cars. I mean, I think they're selling a discount. I think a fleet of like 25,000. Was it 2,500? It's a lot of cars. I can't remember the number now. I want to say it's a lot. There's a flood. There's gonna be a flood of used Teslas that Hertz is literally trying to unload all of them at a monster discount. I think it's $25,000 a car. I think they have to move 25 to 250,000, give or
Wow.
take. And they're doing a fire sale of about $25,000 car, which is more than 50, greater than 50% off Tesla, not including tax credits. So, I mean, Hertz single-handedly is going to flood the market as we speak, unloading their entire fleet.
Yes, that'll bring prices down.
Covering prices down.
Yeah.
And used car market is tricky because, especially for electric vehicles, because you want the greatest, latest technology.
Right,
So,
and the most battery life, yeah.
yeah, because the battery has been minimally used, other than just to, make the, move the motor a bit just to keep it from seizing up for any reason. It's always good to move any mechanical part to begin with every so often. But yeah, I mean, you don't want to get a 4 year used electric vehicle because the battery, has 4 years of wear and tear on it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting to see where that goes. A lot of the manufacturers are pulling back too on investing in electric vehicles.
Yeah, there's a huge forecast now from the big three that they're not going to have, they don't see a huge spike in sales in the second half of this year. Obviously, you all hear the news, the electric car, the BYD, the Chinese company is going to keep sending it to the US and the tariff battle with the US as well as the European Union. The vehicles, which will undercut domestic markets by more than 50%, when they try to sell you a $10,000 electric vehicle made from China, which is substantially less than everyone else, like by more than half. So, those things just should be coming into the US at some point. And again, it creates another competitive supply problem. Now, the tax credits that the feds in particular put out must be American made. There is a threshold regarding the parts as well as assembly of a vehicle inside the United States. There is a threshold percentage that car manufacturer model has to meet for you to qualify for those tax credits, which is why when those credits came out, there was very specific models you could purchase those tax credits. Obviously, the industry had kind of like readjusted themselves after the tax credits to create more models, not all models, but a few more models available for the public. But again, this is a saturation point. Once you buy your electric car, you're not getting one next year. And I think that's the case for anywhere.
Yep, absolutely.
12 years is a long cycle, by the way. 12 years is a long cycle right now on average. I suspect it may go up.
Yes, which is, I guess, good news for repair shops.
Yeah, although I have to admit, the newer the car, generally maintenance isn't that needed for the 5 years unless you got a real lemon. I can do 1 year maintenance on a 2018 Volkswagen. I don't drive a ton. I can do 1 year maintenance. But you can tell by the warranty lengths, how long a car will go before it needs major maintenance. And as you look at car warranties keep going up in years, it's an indication of confidence in the manufacturer that there will be no major problems before the warranty period ends.
Right, obviously, yeah, because they don't want to have to make a major investment if something fails within warranty.
Yeah, you all remember one time it was 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year. You may even see more than 7 years at some point, given the fact that they're so well built, there's such a high level of confidence. Or repair shops will always have work. It's going to be longer stretches as the cars get better made. And the electric cars are not maintained the same way as combustible engine cars. Totally different technology, much less moving parts. And require very different maintenance and will require much more software upgrades, like your cell phone. You're endlessly updating your apps and your cell phone operating system. So, and that's why I always joke around saying these electric cars are kind of like big cell phones. And it's not far from the truth, where the majority of the car is the battery and will constantly need software updates. So, a Tesla recall is not a conventional recall because it's really a software update.
Right.
Although the Cybertruck has like a windshield and a trim problem, so there actually is a like physical recall. I saw one on the road. It was very, never seen one like live, so to speak. And I saw one on 128 one time, and I'm like, that is peculiar looking vehicle.
It's the wave of the future.
It's something, I'll say that much. $100,000 vehicle, just saying.
Yeah. Any I know I like to talk about scams every now and then here, Jackie. Anything updated on to talk about there?
Yeah, I think people need to just keep an eye out. The scams really are picking up. I mean, you got recruiter scams now too coming through on my phone, where you get these random text messages from these so-called recruitment companies working for Amazon or other big box stores. They do not advertise by text message telling you to click on a link. And then, they also like, employment agencies and, all kinds of other farces trying to hook people in. I mean, use the internet to check the actual company or phone them, probably better. Obviously, reach out to us if you're not sure. If you have been scammed, call the cops first, please. And obviously, the FTC and FTC and FCC, Federal Trade and Federal Communications, and they're on top of this, as well as the State Attorney General's office, as well as the Executive Office of Consumer Affairs and the Governor. But yeah, it's scams are coming in really hot and heavy now on your cell phones and your emails. And your spam filter will catch some of it, but won't catch all of it. But keep in mind, people, financial institutions, employers, potential hirers, as well as folks that claim to have money for you, don't communicate by email and text messages.
Right, exactly. Just say no, or just hang up, or just don't answer the door. One or the
Government agencies don't ask for money by telephone, as well
other.
as the deportation. I mean, right now going into this election cycle, I mean, immigrants are in high fear alert again because there's a lot of misinformation about deportation. And obviously you get the ones in Chinese language and Mandarin that tells you before ends of the purpose, give us money or they go, oh, we're going to come deport you because with ICE.
Right.
This is a real thing, and it's going to get worse. So, some of you may have surnames that, sound like a foreign surname depending on the country. But these scammers are targeting people with specific linguistic expectations. So, it's not you. You should not be surprised if you get a phone call saying you'd be deported. And you can kind of dismiss it. Obviously, you're not going to get deported. But it should put in a bug in your ear thinking about the fact of the number of folks that, are afraid, particularly in this, going to be a very, I think, tough election cycle. On the federal level, it's going to be a lot of, I think, immigrant bashing. It's going to be China bashing. I mean, it's going to be a lot of things going on here. People, scammers are going to take full advantage of that fear. And that's going to happen. That's
Yep,
what
that's what they
we're
prey on is fear and uncertainty, right? Yep.
Yeah, give me $10,000, or we'll send the ICE to get you out of the country.
Right.
That's what's going to happen. Kidnapping one's always still shocking. We only have like a family member seriously injured, and they prey on senior citizens in particular. Because your social media. Hang on, my lights went off. Because you put so much information in social media, in particular, data mining is not that difficult to find
Right.
out names of your kids and name of your pets. Your name of your grandkids, it's not that hard to find anymore. I think this is something that, people don't realize is that people have this perception that you need these like Russian hackers to get to you. You kind of stuck it all out there on your own on Facebook and Twitter and any other medium. So you gotta, be conscious of the fact that, you can blame more the evil hackers you want, but you are a participant yourself by putting yourself out there on a medium where it's not that hard to data mine.
Right. Probably going to take a week off for 4th of July next week, Tacky, and check in with you after
It's good that one of us have a week off.
that. I feel no guilt, so don't even try.
Clearly, no guilt on your part, but obviously, I will be taking time off in the after the session closes. But again, everything's still in flux. I don't have all my plans set up properly. Because I'm a little too busy trying to get through the session, plus obviously July 4th events. You have a good time off, Joe, and I'm sure there'll be no shortage of topics when you come back.
I'm sure. So, seeing as you're going to be there, how do folks get a hold of you, Jackie?
Well, you can tell them in the office at room 42 of the State House. I do encourage everyone to please come take a State House tour this summer if you have time to bring bring the family and see the building. If you're inclined to, you can try to make your way to my office to say hello if I'm not here. Obviously, the staff will be here to say hello. You can reach us by telephone at 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tackey.chan at mahouse.gov. That is the obviously my email. I do read my emails. I saw no shortage of at least a dozen email pop-up symbols in the corner of my screen while I was talking to you. Give an idea that in an hour how many emails I will get. At Tacky Chan on X. You got Stay Registered Tacky Chan Facebook. You got tackychan.org, which is mostly a contact page for information. And of course, you have malegislature.gov, which I encourage everyone to visit. The state legislative website is actually very good for you to find bills and watch public hearings and sessions. And you can get a lot of information on your own about me. And then obviously, you see me and Joe here on a near weekly basis, as well as Joe in the morning on QATV, Quincy AM, to get you 10-minute quick hits of what's going on in the city and around the world. So, yeah, no shortage of information available. It's up to you to decide how you want to use it.
That's it. Very good. Happy, safe Independence Day, Tacky.
Well, yeah, I wish everybody a fun Porch Fest weekend, as well as, please enjoy next week. And everyone, please be safe, especially as the weather gets warmer. Be more conscientious over the impact of UV radiation, but also dehydration. And, but everyone have a fun and safe week next week.